Now, a remembrance of writer David Foster Wallace. He was found dead, an apparent suicide, on Friday night. Wallace's novel, Infinite Jest, brought him fame and a wide audience. He was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant in 1997. Writer David Lipsky has this appreciation.
To read David Foster Wallace was to feel your eyelids pulled open. Some writers specialize in the away-from-home experience. They've safaried, eaten across Italy, covered a war. Wallace offered his alive self cutting through our sleepy aquarium, our standard TV, stores, political campaigns. Writers who can do this, like Salinger and Fitzgerald, forge an unbreakable bond with readers. You didn't slip into his books looking for story or information, but for a particular experience, the sensation, for a fixed number of pages, of being David Foster Wallace. He invented a new style and a new comedy. The style, sharp, loaded with footnotes and asides, was the unedited camera. The comedy was of a brain so big, careful, and kind, it kept tripping over its own lumps. In stories and essays, Wallace was drawn to a conflict. How do you live well? And how do you do it without damaging other people, embarrassing yourself? Reporting on a lobster festival, he didn't review the food, the crowds. His attention went to the shellfish in the pot. I spent a week interviewing him after the 1,000-plus-page novel Infinite Jest made Wallace his name. He was faultlessly polite. He lived alone with two dogs. He told me the best books were A Conversation About Loneliness. He said, if a writer does his job right, what he basically does is remind the reader of how smart they are. For someone whose trademark became brilliance, his sense of himself was modest, workmanlike. He talked about shyness, the greasy thrill of being famous. A little part of me likes it, he said, but that part doesn't get to steer. He talked about being lonely, the fear that his tussle with burly, psychic self-consciousness figures might get so bad he'd do damage to himself. He talked about a friend's unsuccessful try at suicide, how it had scared him off. He laughed. I knew that if anybody was fated to screw up a suicide attempt, it was me. When someone very gifted takes their own life, it's like the best student dropping out of high school. There's the tragedy, but it's set in a particular and personal fear. What are they seeing that we don't? The loss to his family is impossible to imagine. The loss to us is easy to imagine. No writer saw the era as clearly. Wallace's readers counted on him to go on, progressing distantly but alongside, filing new reports every couple months, helping us remember how smart we were, inviting us into his crisper world. In his last book of fiction, Oblivion, he wrote about suicide, about emerging from years of literally indescribable war against himself, and ending with the sentence, "Not another word."
David Lipsky is the author of Absolutely American, 4 years at West Point. You can discuss David Foster Wallace's work with other NPR listeners at npr.org.
Like any good mystery writer, Agatha Christie never tired of surprising her readers, even in death. Yesterday, Christie's family released more than 13 hours of previously unheard tapes of the author. Let's listen along with NPR's Lynn Neary.
Christie's grandson found the tapes in an old cardboard box when he was cleaning out the family home. Biographer Laura Thompson says listening to Christie's voice is like eavesdropping on an England that no longer exists.
Even the Queen doesn't sound like that. You know, she was born in 1890, and she sounds like a product of the world that she grew up in.
The tapes date back to the 1960s, when Christie was getting ready to write an autobiography. But for fans of her books, the biographical details may be less interesting than the revelations about her famous characters, the detectives Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple.
Miss Marple insinuated herself so quietly into my life that I think I hardly noticed her arrival.
Miss Marple, Christie said, was like some of her grandmother's cronies, but she was more puffy and spinsterish than her grandmother.
But she had this in common with my grandmother, that although a completely cheerful person, she always expected the worst.
Christie said fans wanted Miss Marple and Poirot to meet, a suggestion she dismissed out of hand.
But why should they meet? I'm sure they would not like meeting at all.
And no doubt, Agatha Christie knew exactly what she was talking about. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
The reporter Dexter Filkins remembers a day when he stood on a dam over the Euphrates River in Iraq. He heard an Iraqi cheerfully ask an American military officer for help in fixing the dam. And then, as soon as the American left, the Iraqi said, "I take their money, but I hate them." Dexter Filkins recounts stories like that in his book, The Forever War.
There were always two conversations in Iraq, the one the Iraqis were having with the Americans and the one they were having among themselves. The one the Iraqis were having with us, that was positive and predictable and boring, and it made the Americans happy because it made them think they were winning. And the Iraqis kept it up because it kept the money flowing or because it bought them a little peace. The conversation they were having with each other was the one that really mattered.
That's Dexter Filkins reading from The Forever War. He's a New York Times reporter who covered the war in Iraq for 3.5 years. He experienced both types of conversations.
I had gone with my really good friend and interpreter, Wazir Jaff, to see a Sunni sheikh. And as we did, Jaff and the sheikh began this long conversation. And it was very animated. And I kept saying to my interpreter, you know, what's going on? I came here to talk to this guy about Sunni politics or whatever. And, you know, he'd put his hand up and say, just hang on, hang on. Finally, it was over. We had a perfectly fine interview. I think the sheikh, you know, served us tea and cookies. And sometime later, when we were back in the car, I turned to Jaff, my interpreter, and I said, what were you guys talking about back there? And Jaff kind of smiled and said, well, he wanted to kidnap you. Fortunately for me, he put that fire out very quickly. But
he said he wouldn't go along with the deal.
Wouldn't go along with the deal. My tribe's bigger than yours. Don't even think about it.
And so how did you try to sort out that question of who was telling you the real story as opposed to the fake story when those two conversations were going on, when your own life is sometimes at risk because of that?
Well, that's the hardest part. I mean, if you want to talk about what it's like to be in Iraq, that's it. It's a labyrinth. It's a hall of mirrors. And I just came from Iraq. It's a lot safer there now, and it's a lot more calm. And so I think the two conversations that I'm talking about, there's less of that now for that reason.
Where did you go in Iraq the last few days?
I went to Baghdad. I mean, I went all over Baghdad, which was remarkable. I mean, I haven't done that since 2004. You know, I watched a wedding procession. It was really, really different.
Well, let's talk about that. And we should say this is a city that you were willing to jog through in late 2003 at night, but then became impossible for almost anybody who was American to move around in for a couple of years. And now you're back. What felt different about it?
Well, it's a remarkable thing because, for example, the park where I used to go jogging in 2003, it was a dead, dying, spooky, absolutely deserted place. I mean, really, really creepy. There were these checkpoints around. There were these guys with guns that didn't have uniforms. There was razor wire that was, you know, crisscrossing the whole thing. I went back there just a couple of weeks ago at sunset. There were probably 2,000 Iraqis. There were women walking around by themselves, which was unheard of. I mean, they had jeans on and they didn't cover their hair. I mean, it was sort of families with children pushing baby strollers. It was completely normal. And so what was so extraordinary about it, I thought Baghdad was dead. And it wasn't dead. It was just hiding. And so when there was order, the life just kind of flowed back into the streets.
You said a minute ago that you went to a wedding procession?
I went to a wedding procession. And actually, it was dusk in Adamiya, again, which was a complete no-go zone 2 years ago, absolutely under control of the insurgents. And this wedding procession came down the street. It was Thursday night when they have all the weddings in Iraq. Probably 25 cars. The lead car was a Mercedes-Benz. And they saw me, and the wedding procession stopped. And the door swung open. And the groom stepped out, and I could see the bride in the car. You know, she's very heavily made up, long white flowing gown. And he shook my hand, and he said, it's wonderful, and then, but then...
Did you have any idea who these people were, or had you just run into the procession?
Just ran into the procession, but what was really fascinating about it was I was in Adamiya to talk to the Awakening people. And these are the former insurgents who are now on the American payroll.
Sunni Muslims.
Who essentially are being, yes, Sunni Muslims, who are essentially being paid not to kill Americans and Iraqis. And I remember when the groom shook my hand, and he said, it's wonderful, he turned and he pointed to these gunmen on the American payroll, and he said, it's all because of them.
What does he mean, it's all because of them? That you could shake his hand, that he could get married, that there wasn't a suicide bombing on the street? What?
All of the above. What the Awakening did, basically, and they're happy to tell you about it, is the insurgents who were kind of reconcilable, more moderate, went after al-Qaeda, who were not reconcilable, who were the guys who were killing the Shiites and driving the civil war. They knew where they lived, you know, third house on the left, take him out. And they did. And I remember talking to this Sunni sheikh, and he said it took us 6 weeks, And we killed 466 Qaeda leaders. And I said, 466? And he said, yes, we have a list.
And not 400, not 500.
466. And so you can see it's what a crazy world it is.
But let me come back to the first point of this conversation, the idea that there are two conversations in Iraq. And if you're an Iraqi, you are compelled to give the friendliest conversation you can to whoever has the nearest gun. Do you sense that that is still happening in Iraq?
Yes, but I think it's different now. I'll give you an example. I was sitting in the office with a former officer in the Iraqi army whose last name was Al-Tikriti, which means he's from Tikrit, Saddam's hometown, Sunni Muslim, probably a former insurgent. And here he was, you know, being paid $500 a month by the American military to keep the peace. I sat in his office and his phone rang and there was somebody shouting into the telephone. And, you know, Mr. Al-Tikriti practically had a nervous breakdown as he was listening to the telephone. And he finally put the telephone down and he said, he humiliated me. He abused me. And I said, who? And he said, well, the Iraqi army colonel who's just down the street, who's a Shiite guy. That shows you the fragility of this whole thing that we've constructed.
Well, did you see anything that struck you as a change that was not fragile, that was permanent and showing the way to a different Iraq?
It's all pretty fragile. I think what struck me as possibly more lasting was that people, ordinary people, wanted peace. I really got a sense, you know, walking through Abu Nawas Park at dusk, looking at 2,000 Iraqis, you know, walking with their families, that this is what they wanted, you know? And so possibly they'll be more reluctant about relying on bad people and they'll be more eager to stand up to the bad people.
Although I can remember thinking the same thing about Afghanistan at the end of 2001. Here's a country that's had more than 20 years of war. People are obviously tired of it. They're exhausted. But turns out that there are some people in Afghanistan that were happy to do another 7 years.
Absolutely. I had an interesting conversation with General Raymond Odierno, who's taking over for General David Petraeus as the lead commander there.
And in Iraq, yes.
What he said to me was ordinary people didn't want the violence, right? It was groups of bad people. So it was on the Sunni side, it was the Al-Qaeda guys who were driving car bombs into Shiite mosques, and then the Shiite militias were going into the Sunni neighborhoods and retaliating. And then, of course, you know, both of those groups were killing American soldiers. But that if they could break that, order and peace would follow. And I think for the moment that appears to be the case. Could it all come back? Probably. Trying to build something that's sustainable there is the big challenge in the future.
Dexter Filkins is author of The Forever War. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I am Meta Ulibi. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we'll meet a young journalist and scholar named Mustafa Bayoumi. His new nonfiction book is called How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. Bayoumi will introduce us to seven compelling young men and women.
Outside, Yasmin was bubbling with excitement over the meeting. She turned to her father. What do you think, Baba? They were walking to the subway, descending the stairs. It's a good case, Habibti, her father said. But I have four daughters. I have to put you all through college. I can't pay $12,000 to $20,000 to bring a case to court that might lose. They waited on the platform, and suddenly Yasmin felt her imminent victory sliding away. But Baba, she pleaded, it's for a good cause. It's for all the Muslims. If it becomes a good law, then it applies everywhere. She had learned this from her legal research. The subway roared in, all rattling noise and clanging steel. Think of the money, Yasmin. It wouldn't be fair to your sisters. They have to go to school, too. He paused, and the conductor announced, stand clear of the closing doors, please. We'll think about it, he said, which in Egyptian parent speak, as Yasmin well knew, really means no.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please go to npr.org/booktour.
I've been reading Philip Roth's stories and novels since I was a teenager. That's more than 40 years, and every year brings a new Roth book. Philip Roth's latest novel, Indignation, is reminiscent of his earliest work. It's about a young man, Marcus Messner of Newark, New Jersey. It is 1951. The country's at war in Korea. Messner goes to a small liberal arts college in Ohio, hoping to escape the family business, an excessively protective father, and the draft. I asked Roth how he might have written this coming-of-age story differently 50 years ago, and he talked about the intervening revolution on college campuses, the sexual revolution.
When I was a boy in college, and I went from 1950 to 54, I didn't see, and I was in a small liberal arts college about 300 miles from home, I didn't see that the mores which dictated my life as a college student, I didn't see them as unduly restrictive or repressive. After the fact, I do. That is, now that life has changed so drastically for young people in college, I realize how harnessed and hemmed in we were, and how overseen we were in ways that I just accepted as the way things were back in 1951.
And later, when you started writing at first, you were writing before all of these enormous changes took place.
Well, I wasn't concentrating on those years or this subject, and so it didn't come up, as it were. I was writing about adults. My book, Letting Go, took place, I guess, in the years immediately following the 50s and before the 60s officially began. And I talked about a different set of serious moral norms in which the characters moved. So I was concerned with the moral norms of the period, but not those of a college and not those of people quite so young.
You seem to have settled into a rhythm of a short novel a year. Is that about it?
In the last 4 years, I think I have, yes.
Does it mean that you're writing full-time? I mean, are you every day sitting down and writing?
Yep. Yeah, I work the same schedule I've worked all my life, really, which is to say I work a full day, and I work 6 or 7 days a week.
And a full day produces about how much on the page?
I always consider the day okay if I can come away with one page. It's not the final page, but the page of that draft. It can produce 3 pages. There are days that are very unpleasant where I produce nothing. That is, I write, but what I write I throw away by the end of the day. And those are not pleasant days.
And those days,
you wouldn't want to have dinner with me.
Would you still have those days?
Oh, indeed I do.
It's not something that practice simply rules out after a while.
Practice in this job is strange because, though I've been doing it for many years now, I think I published my first story in 1956, so that's 52 years ago. And I've been practicing all that time, but each time you start, you're writing a new book, needless to say. And the fact is you've never written that book before, so you may have written before, but you've never written that book before, so you run into problems of a kind you never had before. So the problems are always new, and you have to come up with new solutions all the time.
Marcus Messner, the character in Indignation, is the son of a kosher butcher. And a family that had a kosher butcher shop. And there's some very vivid writing about the butcher shop. I was trying to think, where can you even go find a kosher butcher shop to go describe now?
Well, you can go to Brooklyn.
You can go to Brooklyn. Yes, did you go to Brooklyn?
Yes, I did. There are plenty of kosher butcher shops over there, and they're not unlike the stores of 50 and 60 years ago.
But you actually did go out to
yes,
butcher shops.
Oh, yes, sure. That's the best part of the job, is going to butcher shops.
doing actual research. Yeah. I was wondering if you could read a passage from
sure.
this. And there's a passage where you describe, actually, the butcher shop, and he begins by saying, "My father wore an apron tied around the neck."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. My father wore an apron that tied around the neck and around the back, and it was always bloody. A fresh apron always smeared with blood within an hour after the store opened. My mother, too, was covered in blood. One day, while slicing a piece of liver, which can slide or wiggle under your hand if you don't hold it down firmly enough, she cut her palm and had to be rushed to the hospital for 12 painful stitches. And careful and attentive as I tried to be, I had nicked myself dozens of times and had to be bandaged up, and then my father would upbraid me for letting my mind wander while I was working with the knife. I grew up with blood and grease and knife sharpeners and slicing machines and amputated fingers or missing parts of fingers on the hands of my 3 uncles as well as my father. And I never got used to it, and I never liked it.
And later on that page, a great summing up of social or economic aspiration. All I knew about becoming a lawyer was that it was as far as you could get from spending your life in a stinking apron covered with blood. Which is where your character comes by his ambition. Is this character Marcus Messner? I mean, you see a lot of yourself in this kid?
Oh, I don't see a lot of myself in him. His adventures are totally unlike mine in college. He was smarter than I was. He stayed in ROTC. I was a principled young man, and I quit ROTC because I disapproved of military on the campus. So that meant that when I was drafted after college, I went in as a private rather than as an officer. So much for principles. But I didn't have the other adventures in the book he has, too. But I was a clean-cut, well-behaved, reasonable boy, trying hard and working hard, as he is. I didn't fly off the handle quite so easily, I don't think. But he's in a certain way, he's a generic, successful young man.
And his fate, which I won't go into here so that we shouldn't give away the entire story, but his fate in the end, you write, is an illustration of the incomprehensible way that one's most banal, incidental, even comical choices achieve the most disproportionate result.
Yes, well, that's the lesson his father has been trying to teach him. And as comical as the father may be from time to time in his exaggerated concern, the fact is that the lesson he sets out to teach him, life teaches him. So that's the large comic, tragic irony of the book, I think.
Before I let you go, I just wanted to, I asked you in one interview about movies that had been made. I think I asked you whether The Plot Against America was going to be likely made into a movie, and you mentioned the unfortunate experience you'd had with past novels that had been made into movies. And now, Elegy, your novel, is made into a movie. You've gone to see it?
Yeah, I went to see it.
And you're happy? It's your story? It's somebody else's movie? What do you say?
Well, it's somebody else's movie.
Worth doing just the same?
I guess they thought so.
And you think?
It doesn't matter.
We'll get that quote up on the marquee.
That's a very good one.
Okay. Well, Philip Roth, thank you very much for talking with us once
again. You're welcome.
It's Philip Roth talking about his latest novel, Indignation. You can read an excerpt on the books page at npr.org.
We're going to look back now at one of the great Hollywood studios with film critic Richard Schickel. He's written a book marking the 85th anniversary of Warner Brothers. It's a history that takes movies from what's considered the first talkie, the jazz singer, through a dizzying array of classics, comedies, noir, westerns, wizards, and superheroes. We met Richard Schickel in Burbank on Warner's back lot. There we stood on a city street where brick shops wound to a courthouse and an elevated train. Buildings with nothing in them except lots and lots of history.
That was the bookshop, that one there, where Humphrey Bogart goes in the big sleep, and Dorothy Malone is in there. Okay. Very young, gorgeous young actress at that time.
Is there something I can do for you?
Would you do me a very small favor?
I don't know. It depends on the favor.
She's the clerk in the store, and they start having dialogue, and they start eyeing each other. Eventually, Bogart says, well, you know, I have a little bottle of rye in the car, and, you know, maybe, and he sort of exits, and she takes the sign and turns it from open to closed.
Looks like we're closed for the rest of the afternoon.
And then they sort of drift into the back room.
Hello.
Hello.
It's amazing, in a way, that we can stand here now, and the store is still there.
Well, it's one of the things about this lot. I mean, you know, a lot of the standing sets, I mean, they're just antique. That's the house Jimmy Dean is in East of Eden, you know. So, you know, there's lots of stuff that are touched by the history of movies that were made on the lot that are still here and still functioning. You know, they just redress them and keep using them.
Through all those reused sets and thousands of movies, one constant set Warner Brothers apart. From Hollywood's earliest days, studios like MGM made glossy movies about the upper crust, what Richard Schickel calls white telephone lux. Escapism was popular during the Depression, and Warner spotted an opportunity. It carved out a niche peopled by tragic gangsters, loose women, and more generally, the common man. Movies that were darker and more low down.
They made movies about all kinds of working class people. I mean, telephone repairmen. On the other hand, they would do movies about the Ku Klux Klan, or about lynching in the South, or about maybe the greatest they ever did, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. It's about a guy who's unjustly put on a chain gang in the South.
Now, that's a movie that actually a lot of people won't know unless they're
they should.
It was very dark. It had nothing remotely resembling a happy ending.
It ends in complete darkness. I mean, you know, Paul Muni his girlfriend asks him, what do you do, how do you live? And it goes to blackness, and his reply is said over total black. He says, I steal. You know, that's the end of the movie.
I can't let you go like this. Can't you tell me where you're going? Do you need any money? How do you live?
I steal.
You get the impression there is no hope.
Well, Warner Brothers, that was the other unique thing. They were never afraid of the miserable ending, you know. People would get dead all the time in Warner Brothers movies. That was not true of other studios. I mean, it's very interesting, and, you know, it's hard to say why they were so acceptant of death, doom, and destruction at the end of their movie.
The Warner Brothers. Why were they? They were hands-on running the studio.
I don't think for the last 20 years they ever spoke to each other except in anger. I mean, they all hated each other. Jack and Harry in particular, because Jack was kind of a dandy, kind of a womanizer, loved to sing and dance and tell terrible jokes. And Harry was a believing Jew, you know, he kept kosher, he was very conservative. I mean, the story is Harry chasing Jack around the lot with a lead pipe, trying to hit him.
You're through. You hire these mugs, they miss, now you're through. If you ain't out of town by tomorrow morning, you won't never leave it except in a pine box.
Just talk momentarily about the stars. One of the things that Warner Brothers was doing differently was putting mugs and floozies played by people who were not glamorous.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, someone was talking about Edward G. Robinson, and he says he looks like a mud turtle. And he does. You know, he's not a handsome man. Jimmy Cagney's not a handsome guy.
Would you let me have a dime for a cup of coffee?
There's a buck. Buy yourself a percolator.
These guys were attractive for their energy and their sexiness derived from that.
And also Betty Davis.
Betty Davis would not have been a star at MGM. She could act beautiful. You know what I mean? She carried herself in ways. Mm-hmm. I'm important, I'm significant, I'm somebody to reckon with.
They're coming to a tree in the middle of the road. We're taking it. If you're killed, I'll be free. If I'm killed, it really doesn't matter. If we both die, good riddance.
Good? You've taken everything out of my life. I don't want that without you. Go ahead. Crash it.
Well, you know, clearly Warner Brothers has a huge range of films that it's put out over these 8.5 decades.
Yeah.
But one of the signatures is the working guy. Yet in the late 40s, Warner Brothers ran into quite a bit of trouble with its own workers.
Oh, well, there was a gigantic strike here after the war. Yeah, tear gas was fired. People were beaten up. Pretty vicious strikes. And that really turned the Warners to a much more Republican point of view. And, you know, when the HUAC hearings came along, House on American Activities Committee, I mean, Jack was pleased to go down and testify. And he said he and his brothers would be pleased to subscribe to a fund that would send all these people back where they belong, namely Russia. Jack was not a totally subtle political mind. Except, of course, when it came to the politics of his own studio, where he was very subtle.
Jack Warner's savviness allowed him to steer his studio through the precipitous drop in movie audiences with the rise of TV in the 50s and the breakup of the studio system. Richard Schickel chronicles the studio's 85-year history in a series beginning next week on PBS and the book that goes along with it. They're both called You Must Remember This, after one of the greatest romances in Hollywood history, and typical of Warner Brothers, one without a happy ending.
Those three dormer kind of windows up there, in there is where Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, they're in Paris. She has that line, you hear some cannon fire.
Is that cannon fire? Or is it my heart pounding?
And then they kind of track back out the window. But that is the last little tiny bit of Casablanca that's left on the lot. That's the last memory of that movie.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.